This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Flanagan, is an executive vice president of MTV Networks. He also contributes pieces about music to CBS's show Sunday Morning. His first satirical novel, called A&R, was about the music business. Now he's written a new satirical novel about another world he's very familiar with, cable TV. It's called New Bedlam. The story starts when a very successful TV executive ends up in a reality show scandal and is forced out of network television. To salvage his TV career, he takes the first job he can get, running a group of small-time New England cable channels owned by a man who made his fortune selling cars. He's divided his three low-budget stations among his dissatisfied children. There's the Arts Channel that features pretentious documentaries and performances, the Comic Book Channel that features shows about superheroes and geeks talking about them, and a Boomer Rerun Channel, which devotes a lot of time to showing the father's favorite program, Bonanza. Some of your book almost seems like an homage to Bonanza, I mean, because Bonanza is so important in the book and in the life of the patriarch. Did you grow up with Bonanza?
Sure, didn't we all? Sunday night at 9, you know, the toughest decision you had to make as a kid in the 60s was how to fill that half-hour gap between the end of Ed Sullivan and the beginning of Bonanza. You know, and then the Smothers Brothers came along and we all started growing our hair and listening to The Who, and the Cartwrights kind of faded away. But, you know, I think that aside from the fact that I do have this latent catalog of useless information that I picked up as a child watching Bonanza and I wanted to put it to use, there's also the fact that it is a book about family, and it is a book about the mythologies of families and grown children and their parents and the grief and heartache and laughs that they cause each other. And I thought that in a way Bonanza was a pretty good metaphor. That's the ideal family. That's the perfect impossible relationship where the three grown sons are all handsome and heroic and straight shooters and the father's a great man and they all ride off in the sunset together at the end of every episode. So in
and
a way,
they're all unmarried and they devote all their attention to their father.
Well, you know, we don't know what was going on down in the down among the cattle lowing in the field at the Ponderosa, and we don't want to know. But certainly the sons on Bonanza had a filial devotion, which, again, The Godfather's kind of the same story. You know, there were some wives off scene in The Godfather, but it's basically the same scenario, the powerful father and the three sons, and the middle one's a little goofy, and the oldest one is the toughest, and the youngest one, who they don't pay that much attention to, ends up being the one to take over the father's chair. But again, it's also the story of the Kennedys. And that's not fiction.
You actually have a long passage about Bonanza in your novel. Do you want to read a couple of lines from it?
Sure. This is Dominic King, the nasty old dad who owns the company and tortures all his children, who is insisting that they put Bonanza reruns on their would-be hip channels, and the kids really don't want to do it. And Dom says, "That's a show about family. And it's not some schmuck with no job riding a horse from town to town. It's not about a cop who lives in some house no cop could afford who gets shot in the shoulder every week and never takes a bribe. It's not some nonsense about a talking pig or a talking mule or a talking car or my wife's a witch or my wife's a genie or my wife's a mule or any of that foolishness. No. Bonanza is about a man who's made a lot of money and he's not ashamed of it. And he's been married many times, which is his prerogative." And Kenny, the son, says, "Ben Cartwright's wives died, Dom. He didn't cheat on them and get divorced." "So he says," Dom declared ominously. "You don't know the real story."
That's great. And that's Bill Flanagan reading from his new novel, New Bedlam, which is a satire about cable television. Now, the TV executive who is hired to take over this kind of mom-and-pop cable network, he's best known for the reality shows he created.
That's right.
One of them was called I'll Eat Anything. What was that about?
I'll Eat Anything. We don't really say what I'll Eat Anything was about, but I think it's one of those good titles like Desperate Housewives that pretty much tells you the whole story. Yeah, that's where Bobby began his ascent at the network. He found a series proposal called I'll Eat Anything that was in turnaround from daytime, took it to primetime in the summer, and it became a sensation. And from there, he began his rapid ascent. And what sinks him at the big broadcast network is that he's involved with a series called Lookers, which, you know, I assume is some kind of beauty contest. I'm sure it has a perverse angle. But there is a scandal that erupts when it turns out that the Sweet Girl, who was the season finale contest winner on Lookers, had not actually gotten the most votes. It was the Mean Girl. And someone cooked the books so that the audience would get the result they wanted. And we never really say if he's guilty or not, but Bobby is the guy who's sitting there when they need someone to throw to the posse. So he takes the rap, he's fired, and his life is over at 33. He's spent his whole career climbing up through the big broadcast network, and now he's sunk.
Well, you know, certainly know something about reality shows. MTV does a lot of them. Because you make fun of shows like that in your book of reality shows, what do you think of them? Because you oversee some of them in some way.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, MTV created the genre with The Real World,
mm-hmm.
and that's still going strong. And I think that was a show that was and is very compelling. I mean, you know, not everybody's going to like the same thing. That's true in restaurants, and that's true with baseball teams.
I'm just going to stop you and give a shout-out to, like, The Loud Family as a preceding reality.
Well, I think that's a slightly different thing because The Loud Family, you know, in a way that's true, but that's also a documentary where somebody went in with cameras and followed uh-huh. someone for a long time and then spent a year editing it.
Oh, as opposed to casting for people to be in it?
Yeah, I think it's a little different. I think that, you know, I'm sure we could go back and, you know, probably to the invention of the movie camera and find examples of things that were kind of like reality shows in that they were real life. You know, they were documentaries, but I think that The Real World sure began the current mm-hmm. the current crop, the current dominance of reality on TV. It was a while before the broadcast networks condescended to pick up the form, you know, but it certainly prospered on MTV and then other cable channels and then finally made it to the networks. But then, you know, again, I think a lot of the people at the networks are people who started at MTV and VH1 and other cable channels.
How did MTV go from music videos, you know, being the bread and butter of and the kind of identifying factor of the network to it becoming more about reality shows?
Well, it's a mix of things. You know, there's still a lot of music on MTV and there's a tremendous amount of music on VH1 and there's almost nothing but music on CMT. But, of course, what really happens is that MTV, VH1, CMT and all our other channels are very, very driven by the audience. We listen to the audience. I think, realized early on that you can't, it would be disaster, especially for networks that are geared toward teenagers and college-age people, for the people running it to say, this is the way we do it, this is the way we do it, this is the way we do it. You get locked into the way it's always been done, and the way it's always been done is death. So you follow what the audience is enthusiastic about, you follow what the audience cares about, and the audience tells us very quickly and very loudly when they don't like something. And the fact is that the audience's enthusiasm and what the audience is interested in changes every few years, just as the new class of college students changes every few years. And we reflect that. You know, we'll try something, maybe in some corner at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, and if it explodes, if the audience says more of this, then they get more of that. And at the same time, in my experience, when you try to force something that you think is good for them down their throats, they'll tell you real quickly that, you know what, I'm in school all day. I don't need to be in school when I come home.
What's an example of a show like that?
Well, on VH1, about 10 or 12 years ago, we were doing, and I was involved with a lot of great shows, one still on the air, Storytellers, and we had Legends, and then Behind the Music, which Jeff Gaspin came up with, and a lot of great success with very music-oriented series. And someone came in with a notion for a show called Classic Albums, which would be the making of and sort of dissection of and story of a great record album. Let's do The Band. Let's do Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. Let's do Graceland. And as a music nut, I was wildly enthusiastic about that. We funded the show. We were involved editorially, and I still think it was great. It was a great series. But it was too high and inside for the audience. It was further than they wanted to go. They really weren't that interested in how the bass track was constructed or, you know, sitting at the mixing board and watching the producer move the faders up and down. So, you know, the audience tells you. The audience says, you know what, this Behind the Music thing with the true tragic story of the captain and Tennille or how Nikki Sixx almost overdosed, that's great. We enjoy that. We love it. We'll watch it over and over again. This bit where you're, you know, sitting with Robbie Robertson watching the composition of The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, why don't you guys just take that home and watch it among yourselves?
How frustrating do you find that?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of like if you were running a restaurant and you thought that the Cajun shrimp was just the greatest thing you'd ever come up with, and people kept ordering the steak. Well, at a certain point, you know, we're not here to be dictators. We're not here to stand up in front of the class and tell them what their assigned reading is. You know, we're here to serve the audience.
My guest, Bill Flanagan, is the author of a new novel, a satirical novel about cable TV called New Bedlam, and he's also an executive vice president at MTV. And since we're talking about MTV, there's a paragraph about MTV in your novel that I want you to read from page 184.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I really went back and forth on whether I wanted to mention MTV in the book, but this is a bit where an old network newsman is talking about how MTV changed the visual vocabulary of television, and there was just no way to get around it. The fact is, this is an influence MTV had, and to try and cop out of it by not mentioning the company I work for would have been really phony. So here we go. MTV had changed the vocabulary of television. Even here in the stuffiest old corner of the network news division, Weekend Daylight, the young producers were frightened to hang on a human face for more than 5 seconds without jumping to a shot of something else. Dash told friends from the old days that if he happened to say on camera that a boy at the ball game was eating a hot dog, they'd cut away to a 1 second shot of a hot dog. To everyone over 35, the MTV vocabulary was one of many editing styles, and a silly one at that. To directors under 35, it was simply the way TV was supposed to look. The new assumption was that the broadcaster's job was to click before the viewer could, to outdraw his remote control, to skip a second ahead of his tiny attention span.
Given that you think that there is this generational divide in terms of shooting styles, it's an interesting paradox for you because you're probably in your 50s.
I'm 52.
Okay. And so you're pre-MTV in terms of your TV genes.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
But you're programming for the post-MTV generation who have, as you point out, a different sense of like what the pacing and editing on television should be. So how do you compensate for being on the other side of the generational divide?
Well, I think you learn as you go, don't you? I mean, it's not as if I hadn't been watching TV in the meantime, and it's not as if I haven't learned a lot from working at the company. And, of course, also, if you sit in an editing bay, then you follow your instincts. You know, you say, I think that this is lingering too long, or I think we can hold on this face for a little bit longer. It's you very much make it up as you go along. You respond to your own enthusiasms first. But like everyone, I have been changed by the way the editing of TV has changed, regardless of how old you are. You know, people who are 70 years old have been changed. If you look now at TV shows from the mid-60s, if you look at I Spy, for example, which is a great old show, it's astonishing how slowly it moves. You just can't believe it. I saw an episode of I Spy not too long ago where Kelly and Scotty were being held prisoner, and they were playing cards in the cell while they were waiting for the guards to come and open the door so they could punch them in the nose and escape. And they sat there playing cards for what seemed like forever. You know, I mean, maybe it was 2 minutes. But these days, you would never do that. If you look at old TV shows, if someone says, now we're going over to Joe's house, there has to be a shot of them driving in the car and getting out at Joe's house and knocking on the door. Now it would just cut from one place to the other. Everyone has been changed by that. None of us are still looking for that old, slow-moving kind of style. We've all gotten used. We've all made the change together.
One of the characters in your novel, Dash, is a local newsman close to retirement who feels like he's kind of at the end of the line. But he's asked to come into this cable network that the TV exec has been hired to take over and refurbish.
Yeah.
So you have a great description of Dash, the close to retirement newsman.
Yeah, Dash is in this scene just finished taping his Sunday morning segment for Weekend Daylight, which is kind of the end of the trail. You know, there isn't really anywhere left to fall. Dash never became the anchor, and now he's close to retirement age. So Dash left the studio to the usual compliments from Rudy and the makeup woman and the usual silence from the crew. He went into the men's room and scrubbed away his tan. There were 8 orange paper towels on the side of the sink when he was clean. There were network stars not much older than Dash who wore their makeup all the time, even on airplanes and in the street. What began in their 50s as no time to wash it off became in their 60s a habit. They put on their war paint in the morning, as soon as they shaved, struggling to look as they had when they first became anchors. They froze themselves in the face they had worn when they peaked. With each year, their bodies shriveled and their heads dilated. In real life, they looked like light bulbs on sticks. But they did not spend much time in real life. They lived on television, and on television they looked ageless. Those old lions might be snickered at by their staffs, but they were untouchable. They had their primetime magazines and news specials. They had contracts worth millions of dollars. They put their names on ghostwritten bestsellers. They were in demand as commencement speakers and at journalism schools. Dash had never cracked that club. He had been a local star as an anchor in Boston and D.C., and when he finally moved up to the network in the 70s, he got plenty of airtime. He did some weekend anchoring, too, but he had no illusions about his prospects now. Doing essays on the weekend edition of the early morning show was the last stop before the train ran out of track.
Is Dash based on someone that you knew?
A little bit. Dash is, I mean, this fellow was never quite in that position, but my father's best friend when I was growing up was a broadcaster named Arch McDonald from Boston, who was the anchor of the evening news in Boston from 1948 when he and WBZ made the transition from radio to TV, and he stayed there until the 70s. And one of the things about Arch, who we saw every weekend and who went on vacation with us every summer, was he was very, very courtly. He was really, he could hit his thumb with a hammer and he would not use an obscenity. He'd been trained that way from radio and live television, you know, at a time when a slip like that could have ended your career. And he was just genuinely a very kind, nice man. And it was interesting to me as a kid because he knew the Kennedys really well. He'd done the first TV interview with JFK when he was a young congressman. He had met all of the powerful figures of the 60s and 70s, and yet he still had, as smart as he was, a kind of naive view of the world, a very old-fashioned patriotic view. He was completely stunned that Nixon would lie to the country. He couldn't get over that. He was of that greatest generation, and he took things very seriously. And I thought that someone like Arch would have had no place in the current TV world. He was a little too much of a gentleman. And, I do pieces for CBS Sunday Morning up at the 60 Minutes studios, and I have to say that there is around that place a little bit of that old courtliness and just sense of good manners and being a gentleman that's almost gone out of television. So I think with Dash Ryan in this book, I just kind of wanted, first of all, I thought it would be funny and dramatic to throw someone like that into the kind of sleazy world of King Cable. But I also a little bit wanted to pay tribute to the time when network news people were really dignified and they were almost like a little bit of a priesthood.
The one of the main characters in your novel starts off as a network executive, and he says that the title of vice president has been so kind of deflated in importance because, like, by the 1980s, the number of network vice presidents expanded to where it seemed like there was a vice president of paper cups and a vice president of parking spaces.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you're an executive vice president at NTV.
I know. Well, who's benefited more than I? You know, I mean, Hemingway drove an ambulance to find material for his book. All I had to do was sit around and negotiate unwarranted promotions.
So do you feel like your title is inflated?
Well, so is my salary. my wife would say, so is my ego. This is just the world we live in, and I'm describing the world we live in.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's good or bad. I mean, it's good for me personally, I suppose. But, we all have these kind of impressive-sounding titles that I sometimes think are there so that when we get fired, we can have better-looking resumes.
One more thing. One of the characters in your novel says that he really needs a low-impact Monday, and that's an expression I've never heard. And I think it's a great expression. I can really use a few low-impact Mondays myself. Did you make that up, or is that an expression everybody except me knows?
No, I think I made that up. We can only hope it passes into the vocabulary. I think that there have been times in my life when I have sat in my office with an ice pack on my head and just said, low-impact Monday, low-impact Monday. It means try to schedule as few meetings as possible for Monday, make as few decisions as possible on Monday, and don't commit to do anything Monday night. Just get through Monday, and by Tuesday, you'll be back in the swing of things.
Bill Flanagan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a blast. Thank you very much.
Bill Flanagan's new satirical novel about television is called New Bedlam. He's an executive vice president of MTV Networks.